The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to have some high school students with us today. Is Cashton High School here today? Would you please stand? Thank you. We're delighted to have you with us. Central Wisconsin Christian. Would those students please stand? Glad to have you with us, too. You may be seated. And Columbus High School students. Good seeing you all. You may be seated. These students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students are invited to come and hear an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, they will appear. They will have received briefs of the case we're about to hear and may have engaged in some activities related to the case. And then, after this oral argument, they will meet with a justice of this court to discuss the procedures the court uses in taking and deciding cases. Everyone is invited to join the students and the justice after this case is heard. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your right hand, the marshal will give you a summary. All right, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you're going to meet after this case. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we are going to call our second case, 2005 AP-2742, Dennis Cockin versus Wisconsin Council 40 AFSCME. Arguing on behalf of Wisconsin Council 40 AFSCME is Bruce Elke. Attorney Elke, you may proceed.
If it please the court, Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, good morning. I am Bruce Elke, as the Chief Justice has indicated. I am with the law firm of Hawks, Quindell, Elke & Perry, and I am here today on behalf of the Brown County food service workers and the local union that represents them. The case that we are here to talk about is another one of the cases concerning the constitutional power of a county sheriff. The issue in this case is whether a decision regarding who will prepare the meals for the Brown County Jail inmates is a decision that falls within the ambit of the constitutional power of the sheriff, or whether it is subject to the terms of a statutory, collectively bargained agreement between the Brown County Board of Supervisors and the AFSCME local union, Local 1901. Specifically, the question and what's at dispute here is whether the jail inmates' meals will be prepared by county food service workers or by the employees of a private contractor. The parties have filed extensive briefs. I think the matter's been pretty nicely briefed, but there are a few things I'd like to say in addition to what's in the brief. In thinking about this matter in preparation for this argument today, one of the things that occurred to me, and one of the things that passed through my mind, is that what we have to address here is the psychologist or psychiatrist might call it a dual personality or mixed personality or multiple personality, at least jurisprudence-wise. And I'm talking here about the legal status of a county sheriff. Historically, I would submit, it is pretty well established that the duties and responsibilities of a sheriff, county sheriff, have, at least as far as we've been able to determine, and as far as is a matter of record in this case, the duties and responsibilities have been delegated, defined, or delineated by statute, beginning with our Northwest Ordinance many, many years ago, followed by the territorial laws of Wisconsin, and to date. Early in the history of our state, in 1887, in the McDonald case, the Supreme Court was asked to address the scope of the authority of the sheriff's power, and in that case, the McDonald case, where the sheriff had contended that he had the authority on his own to retain the services of certain people related to his law enforcement responsibilities, the Supreme Court held that absent statutory authority, the sheriff did not have the power to retain these the people in question to help him. That statutory framework, that scheme, has continued down to the present day where, as we know, there are a variety of statutes that relate to the authority of a sheriff, the authority that is exercised both with respect to the hiring and employment of law enforcement personnel, including jail personnel, the feeding of jail inmates, and related matters. Some of us may even recall, as it relates to the statutory authority, some of us may even recall there was a time when we employed what were called traffic patrolmen into the early 60s. For a number of decades, counties were authorized by statute to employ highway patrolmen to enforce the traffic laws of the state of Wisconsin. Subsequently, of course, in the mid-60s, the most traffic patrol departments were merged with the county governments. If you want a reference for that, just by way of an example, Section 83.016 of the 1963 statutes still provided for these traffic patrolmen. The point here is the statutory scheme as it related to the sheriff's authority has been with us for a long time and into the present time. And
Counselor, would you agree that the care and the custody of prisoners in a jail is part of the sheriff's constitutional obligation to the citizens of the state?
I would say it's a statutory responsibility. It is provided for by statute.
What about Constitution? I'm not interested in the statute. My question goes to the Constitution.
My answer to that is no. I do not believe that the care and feeding of the inmates is a constitutional
obligation. What is the sheriff's constitutional obligation to the citizens of the state as you see it then?
The problem, Justice Rowensack, is this. And the problem I'm having answering your question is, as I read the case law, and as I have reviewed the history relating to the sheriff's power in our state, I don't see the issue presented as an issue of the power, the inherent power of the county sheriff. I see the issue presented as was framed initially in the Brunst case, which was where the constitutional right that was at stake was the right of the electors to elect a sheriff, someone to fill an office that had identifiable characteristics that were identifiable at law at the time the Constitution was adopted as the responsibilities, that the characteristics of a sheriff. That was what was at stake in the Brunst case.
So you're saying that the identifiable characteristics are only those established by statute?
No. I'm saying that, as I understand, it's the Brunst case and the Bick case, B-U-E-C-H case, the 1920 case out of Milwaukee County, that what those cases teach us, I believe, is that the electors, because the sheriff is named in the Constitution, as are a number of other county officers, coroners, district attorneys, register of deeds, and so forth, because the Constitution has guaranteed to the electors the right to elect a person to fill those offices, the legislature cannot change the duties and responsibilities of those offices in such a way that the office doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that was the concern in the Brunst case. And I believe that, and I would submit that in the Beek case, the 1920 case, what happened, what the court did there was it, if you will,
Counselor, I understand the cases, and I'm sure everyone has read them that's participating here today. What I'm trying to understand that I didn't understand in the briefs is, do you see any constitutional obligations that lie with the sheriff in performing his obligations once he's elected? That's what I'm not understanding from you.
And I've been thinking about that, and I've been thinking about that as recently as this morning in preparation for this argument. I think the answer to your question is no.
Well, then, if the answer is no, then why is the legislature restricted in such a way that they can't cause his obligations of office to cease to exist?
Because if the legislature were to do that, then the right of the electors to elect a sheriff would cease to exist.
Right, but it follows from that if they can't cause his obligations to cease to exist, he must have some constitutional obligations. And I don't. I have trouble with that.
Okay, I think we're dueling over semantics here.
Perhaps
you're referring to as a constitutional obligation or responsibility if you're thinking of it in terms of like a circuit court's constitutional authority or the authority of a governor, which cannot be interfered with or substantially impaired by another branch of the government. In that sense, the sheriff does not have a constitutional power. The sheriff has a constitutional power in the sense that, and those are the words that were used in the Brunst case, mm-hmm. in the sense that as an officer of the county government named in the Constitution, the legislature cannot change his powers to such an extent that there's no longer a sheriff.
Now, but are the powers that they can't change?
I would submit, and I'll go right to the bottom line, okay? The bottom line, as I see it, is that if I can just, if you give me maybe 30 seconds to lead into this.
Okay.
I historically, I believe that what I'm arguing has been the law. I believe that beginning about two, maybe three decades ago, in analyzing the sheriff's powers, we began to diverge from this historical way of looking at the sheriff's authority. I mean, even up to recent years, the case law, the opinions of the Attorney General are replete with references to the fact that the sheriff derives his powers from the statute. Now, I'm getting around to my point here.
That's okay. I'm waiting for you.
Thank you. In 1982, in the Dane County case, the Supreme Court used the language, it is the nature of the job assigned that we look at in determining whether the sheriff's constitutional powers are implicated, not the job, the authority to assign the jobs, or words to that effect. In reflecting on this, I believe that was an unfortunate choice of words, with all due respect. Because it was that language that the court then built on in the Mantua County decision, and it's that language that was relied on by the Court of Appeals in the Washington County case, where ultimately what had begun as a concern for the constitutional right of the electors came down to the question that was posed by the Court of Appeals in the Washington County case, which was whether the nature of the job assigned was for the purpose of law enforcement. In other words, by looking at the nature of the job assigned to measure the constitutional power, essentially everything the sheriff does becomes fault in the ambit of his constitutional power. And then one has to, frankly, question all of these statutes that relate to the sheriff's position. Now, I believe, and I would submit, that a better analysis would be, first, is the function that's at issue a function, a responsibility that distinguished the office of sheriff, not in the sense that the sheriff has gray hair and so he's a distinguished person, but rather distinguished in the sense that it was one of those functions that identified that particular office of the county government as the office of the sheriff.
Counsel, can I just, in we're talking historically, maybe it's because of my advanced age, but I would say that in many, many, many years ago, the sheriff always provided generally for the food in the jail. In fact, I think you're well aware of generally when they had a sheriff and it was a two-year term, it was the sheriff that or his spouse would be the keeper of the jail, the provider of food, and there was a certain stipend or supplement that was paid. In fact, that became an issue politically when, as I understand it. So there is a historical background of the sheriff being involved in the food.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree with that.
Okay.
Yes. And I would submit to you that in fact, was one of the historical powers of the sheriff.
Let's just double back. You started your argument that the sheriff is a dual personality in terms of powers, and that and I understood you to say, therefore, it has some constitutional duties that can't be easily meddled with by the legislature or the court, and that it has other duties that are subject to regulation by the legislature. That's the dual personality, isn't it?
Actually, no.
Okay, what's the dual personality?
The dual personality was a reference to the fact that subsequent to the court adopting this, or not adopting, but articulating the test in terms of the nature of the duties assigned, what has developed is an analysis that, depending on what case you read, there are cases as recently as this Kleismet case that was cited by the Badger Sheriff's Association, where the sheriff initially had invoked his constitutional power regarding a statute that required him to maintain Department of Corrections inmates in his jail. He invoked his constitutional power to stop that practice, and he was enjoined. The Department of Corrections was permitted to continue to, per the statute, house the prisoners in his jail, the inmates. Subsequently, 10 years later or so, the matter came before the court again, and the court engaged in a statutory analysis. And in a footnote, the court said, we do not have to reach the constitutional question. It's a statutory question. The analysis was a statutory analysis. The dual personality I'm talking about here is undesirable as far as I would suggest. It's undesirable because what we've got is we've got a line of cases that continue to apply a traditional statutory analysis, harmonization of the statutes, interpretation, and so forth, traditional as it relates to the sheriff's power. But then every once in a while, a case like this comes up where the sheriff says, wait a second, I've got constitutional power, and my constitutional power surpasses the statutory power it controls. Well, that's where the dual personality I'm referring to. This idea, this line of cases that continues to the present day, which analyzes the sheriff's authority in terms of what does the statute say, which on top of which is superimposed this other personality. It's kind of like the super sheriff. He puts behind the statutes and he puts on his cape with the big S on the front and he says, I am a constitutional office. I have constitutional powers here which supplant, which...
And there are cases that say that, that he has constitutional powers and they are not to be interfered with by the legislature.
But what I would submit is the concern, the constitutional concern is not that the sheriff has some kind of an inherent power like a court or the governor, but rather it's a negative, if I could, or maybe a passive constitutional power in the sense that, as the Bruns case articulated it, the Bruns case said it's the sheriff is a constitutional officer in a sense. It's a passive thing. It's a negative thing. The legislature cannot strip the sheriff of certain functions.
Well, a lot of water has gone over, under, or around the dam since 1870. Now, are you asking this court to reverse several opinions of this court and the Court of Appeals that says something like this? That under Wisconsin Constitution, the sheriff has certain powers and prerogatives derived from the common law. These powers cannot be limited by collective bargaining, citing Heitkemper and Wisconsin Professional Police versus Dane. While the Constitution doesn't define these duties, there can be no doubt that the framers of the Constitution had reference to the office with those generally recognized legal duties and functions belonging to it when the Constitution was adopted, citing a 1920 case. However, only the immemorial, whatever that means, principal and important duties of the sheriff at common law are constitutionally protected regardless of their uniqueness. Manitowoc County versus AFSCME. Only a memorial principle and important duty of the sheriff at common law are constantly protected. And in the case, and I'm reading from the most recent case, 2006, Dunn County versus Work, Court of Appeals case. Then it goes on and says, you have to analyze the job in light of the constitutional powers. Another cite to WPPA 2. If the duty is one of those immemorial, principal, and important duties that characterize and distinguish the office of sheriff at common law, the sheriff may choose the ways and means and can't be limited by collective bargaining. By contrast, and this is the dual personality as far as I'm concerned, internal management and administrative duties, while important, fall within the mundane and commonplace duties not preserved at common law, citing Heitkemper. So, at common law, the sheriff probably could hire his brother-in-law and everybody else in the family to be deputies.
Probably did, right.
Probably did, right. On the other hand, it's been recognized that it is the sheriff's constitutional duty to keep the peace, make arrests for crime, but that the sheriff does not have a constitutional power to hire whomever he or she wants. That those are mundane powers, that is, personnel is mundane. It's not limited to the sheriff. Every officer of the state has that power.
Yes.
And therefore, collective bargaining can determine who the deputies will be. Isn't that the principle now? And you look at it case by case.
It is.
Going to change that law?
What I'm asking the court to do is take a hard look at the history that I've been talking about.
Well, the hard look is you can't tell one from the other. That's the hard look.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the problem is when we talk about looking at the nature of the duties assigned, it leads to the kind of arguments that we're presenting here today, the dispute that's before the court today. And what I'm suggesting that it would be is that it would be helpful if we would, rather than addressing these issues in expansive terms, look at the nature of the duties assigned, which is essentially an expansive term. We look back at what originally was the idea here, which is to protect the particular, to maintain those characteristics, those functions of the office that were special. And what I'm suggesting is I don't think we have to overrule anything at this point, although, to be frank, it's sometimes hard to understand exactly what the analysis was in some of these more recent cases. But you don't have to overrule anything. All I'm asking for is a little bit more clarification, maybe a more limiting clarification of what it is that constitutes the constitutional power of a sheriff.
I'm wondering if part of the problem in this case is I'm not sure, part of my problem is, I'm not sure what our focus is. Is our focus the delivery, who makes the meals? Is that, I could call it the delivery of food service, but let me do it much more in the vernacular. Who's making the meals? Is that what we're talking about? Or are we talking about a sheriff's power to have rehabilitative programs that help assist inmate reintegration into the community? What are we talking about here? Are we talking about both? And if we're talking about both, is one predominant? Are they both real? So what are we talking about? Before we can analyze whether or not that duty is an immemorial principle that's constitutionally protected or mundane commonplace, we have to focus on what duty we're talking about or primarily talking about.
Right. I mean, depending on who's making the argument, me or Mr. Godar here, the answer is going to be it's the decision to provide the food service, or it's going to be this lofty decision to provide rehabilitation services.
Well, since we don't know, and the trial court didn't make any finding, why don't we send it back to the trial court for a finding of fact as to what is the predominant purpose or the real purpose here that we should be looking at?
Should
we decide that? Should we decide what are we really looking at?
I would encourage the court to engage in a different analysis than has been engaged in the last couple of decisions. The problem is that when your analysis is based on the nature of the duties assigned, inevitably you open yourself up to the kind of dispute that's before you today. Because then it becomes, as you've suggested, maybe in each case you have to weigh in the balance which element of the decision, whether it relates to the food service or it relates to the social services rehabilitation program, is the predominant one. I mean, it strikes me that that's a could be a pretty problematical approach.
Mr. Elke, if the court accepts your view of this, that the collective bargaining applies, that there is no inherent core power based on the Constitution for the sheriff to do this. Let's say we have Sheriff Bradley. Sheriff Bradley wants to outsource food preparation for the jail. How does she achieve that objective? How does she achieve her goal?
As any other officer named in the Constitution, county officer would do it, and that would be to work through the county board, and to the extent there was a statutorily represented labor organization involved, negotiate. That's how it would be done.
Now, does the sheriff have a contract now with the county that the county provide meals?
My understanding is that at the present time, the contract, the sheriff's department has a contract with the Aramark Corporation.
With whom? Yes, but I mean, previously to that, the sheriff must have had an arrangement with somebody.
Yes.
For the provision of food, right?
Yes, he did.
What was that?
The arrangement was that the food service would be prepared, the meals would be prepared and provided by county employees who worked in a kitchen that had been built in conjunction with the construction of the new jail.
Was that a contract with the county board, or was that a contract with the union? Who was the contract with?
I'm not sure it was a contract, but it was an arrangement.
Agreement.
It was an arrangement with the other departments of the county government. And the most immediately affected department was the Health and Family Services Department.
Justice Wilcox?
No, you asked the same question. It's just to,
so what you have to do to answer Justice Price's question, if you want to change that, you have to say to the county, we're not, or whoever the arrangement is with, we're not going to have you do it. We're going to have somebody else do it. And the county's employees are covered by a collective bargaining agreement. And your position is that removing them from the job violates the collective, removing them without bargaining with them about that removes them from the job.
Sure, just as was the case in the Heitkemper case and in the Brown County Deputies Association case, where the removal of an individual was, yes.
My question that I'm going to ask, the sheriff was not part of this collective bargaining agreement, was or was not?
The record is not clear on that, but it does appear that the predecessor to the current sheriff was involved in making the arrangements that the current sheriff decided to set aside.
Was there a written obligation? That's all I want to know.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I mean, I think my understanding is the process was the same process as ordinarily used in the course of conducting business within county government.
Counselor, if there had been no prior arrangement with county employees, would we still be here? There was a period of time when the sheriff's own employees and the inmates prepared the meals before the county employees prepared them. So if we didn't have that interim slice, would we still be here?
Maybe, because the county employees who provided the food service were represented by a labor organization, not the one that I represent, but they were represented by a labor organization.
Okay, thank you.
But if they never got involved in this to begin with, would they be objecting now?
The original?
Suppose the sheriff and his whole family and the inmates prepared the meals, right? It's not very likely, but it's possible in a small jail. Okay. Now the sheriff and his family are not happy about doing that, so they are now going to contract with a food service. Would the union be involved under those conditions?
It might be.
You have to stand in front of the microphone when you're ready to speak.
There was an opinion of the Attorney General. It's from 1951. The citation is, it's in volume 40 of the opinions of the Attorney General at page 140. And the Attorney General at that time opined that by statute the sheriff is to provide the food service personally. That's what they emphasized in the opinion, personally was to provide the food service. This is the sheriff and his family, you know, which was the practice in those days. The opinion of the Attorney General went on to say that, however, if the sheriff were to use a deputy and to not do it himself or with the assistance of his spouse, then the sheriff would be required to follow the civil service ordinances. That's found at pages 143 and 144.
But the example I gave you, was that you're not hiring a deputy, you're not hiring a county employee, you're hiring a third person.
Yes.
Would that affect the collective bargaining agreement?
If there was a collective bargaining agreement in place, I would say yes, it would, because collective bargaining agreements are simply, as I understand it, another way of managing
Yeah. Well, you'd have to look at the collective bargaining agreement to see whether it covers or not.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Elke. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldar, representing the sheriff.
May it please the court. I thank you very much for the opportunity as a counsel for Sheriff Dennis Kogan to present this case for the respondent. I am Tom Goldar of the law firm of White Hirschbeck Dudek. The court obviously has an excellent grasp of the issues, as you can tell from the questions and the colloquy with Mr. Elke. But I bring the court back to a day 136 years ago where perhaps in those chairs behind the justices, the Supreme Court said in State X. Rel. Kennedy versus Brunst, there can be no doubt that the framers of the Constitution had reference to the office with those generally recognized duties and functions belonging to it in this country and in the territory when the Constitution was adopted. Among those duties, one of the most characteristic and well acknowledged was the custody of the common jail and the prisoners therein. That specific definition of constitutional authority of the sheriff has not been challenged in 136 years, and my notes actually said, nor does the appellant challenge it here. I'm no longer sure.
But let me ask you this. Can the sheriff, I'll accept that. Can the sheriff hire whomever he or she wishes to be jailers?
You know, there are only three cases in 150 plus years of constitutional history where the sheriff's authority was curbed, even though bringing forth a constitutional question. Those three cases were the, I pronounced it differently than Mr. Elke, the Beach case, whatever that case was from 1920, and I couldn't find anyone to ask. There was the Heitkemper case, decided in 1995, as well as the Brown County case. Those three cases had one thing in common. That is, sheriff's deputies and the hiring of them was seen as commonplace and administrative.
That's why I'm asking about the jailer.
And those are the only three times that we have that.
It seems to me that the jailer fits into those cases. If you look, a prime duty, I think you'll agree, of the sheriff is crime control.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And who's out in the patrol cars? The deputies, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And if the sheriff can be restrained in hiring deputies, right?
As the Heitkemper case teaches.
As the cases say, why can't the sheriff be restrained as to hiring jailers?
Well, and that's not our case before us.
I know
today,
that, but I want you to answer that first.
In the context of a civil service, if this was a question of whether or not the court was asking whether this sheriff could hire jailers without any regard to either a collective bargaining agreement or a civil service, the answer would be that the Beach case and the Heitkemper case would say, no, we're going to find some way to understand that power within the constitutional rights.
Although jail is a constitutional power of the sheriff, it is not unlimited, right?
The constitutional authority of the sheriff has certainly been limited, Chief Justice Abrams.
So then the next question is, if the sheriff is limited as to hiring jailers, why is the sheriff not limited as to hiring food service people?
Well, I think that the court has made it clear that when we're looking at this constitutional issue, we have to look carefully at the facts of the case. The Dunn case taught us that from the Court of Appeals just last year. And that has been the role of this court or the lower courts to look carefully at the factual background. And we don't get such a limited factual background here. We understand that the factual background is far greater than merely who turns the knob on a stove, a cook. I think that the union would have the court think that that's all we're talking about here, but I believe it was Justice Wilcox who said, and perhaps it was Justice Bradley who echoed, what's the central theme here and what are we talking about? We're focusing on something much broader than turning on the stove for the macaroni and cheese. We're talking about something that everyone agrees, I think, is a duty of the sheriff to maintain a jail and the care and custody of the inmates therein. In this case, If you look at the history, this jailer, this sheriff, maintained that, according to the record, with his family. He then had a few employees who supervised the inmates. The inmates gave way in an agreement with the county for the mental health center employees to have a contract relationship with the jail. But it wasn't just that relationship that we're talking about here today. We're talking about safety of the inmates and the correctional officers who see to them. That was seen as a very significant role, giving the sheriff authority to make decisions in the Kleinsman cases we discussed earlier.
Could I ask,
if Sheriff
Bradley wanted to hire, if Sheriff Bradley wanted to outsource the actual security at the jail, so that both intake and the people who are monitoring the cells and that sort of thing, escorting the prisoners in the jail, could she do that?
The question has been asked. It's been asked of attorney generals, and it's been asked of the court, even in the Brunst case, which is, if you're going to take all of the authority away from the sheriff, then no, probably not, because the sheriff has to serve a role of maintaining the jail and the prisoners. Within the context of some activities where there's a private-public relationship or a public-public relationship, this court and the Court of Appeals has said, yes, there's an opportunity to do that. This court and the Court of Appeals has said, yes, when you're talking about a relationship to have individuals transported, inmates transported, you may have a relationship outside of your direct employees. In this case, it was a U.S. Marshals right here in Dane County, and that was not seen as somehow delegating so far away from the sheriff's duties that it was improper. Likewise, in
so the answer to his question is what? If Sheriff Bradley wanted to outsource the security of the jail, can she do that?
I believe so, and I believe that that's not improper delegation.
Well, let me ask here,
Justice,
since there was outsourcing here, and I know this argument is made by one of the briefs, when the food was purchased from the county employees themselves, they weren't sheriff's employees, they were outside of that scope. So, and I asked opposing counsel whether or not they were party to this agreement, and to this union contract. No, but there may have been an agreement, whatever it was. But is this any different? So you have, you're purchasing from, what is it, Aardmark?
Aardmark, Justice Wilcox.
And whether they're unionized or whether they aren't, could the same argument be made there? Well, you're talking about people that have these jobs. They may lose them because you're switching the service. You're going from that service to a so-called private service. But in any event, the sheriff never had anything other than an agreement to purchase food brought into the jail.
In 2001, when the jail was built, the sheriff chose an agreement with the mental health center to provide the food. And there's a historical reason for it. The historical reason is no longer valid. They thought that the mental health center would be built contiguously. But that was a choice the sheriff made. And interestingly, the record reflects that the county executive at that time recognized that the sheriff had that authority, which would not be curbed by the county. So the answer, Justice Wilcox, is indeed the sheriff had made a choice to go outside of his own employees with no one at that time, of course, objecting, and has now made a choice to change that contractual relationship from the mental health center employees to other employees, and that has allowed a great deal more than just who's turning the knob on the stove. It's allowed for the safety. It's allowed for a reduction in recidivism because the inmates, and really that's one of the great focuses that we ought to have here and not just talk about turning on the macaroni pot. The inmates are well served, and that's what we always expected sheriffs to do, to take care of inmates. The inmates are served by training. They're served by good time opportunities. They're served by about 40,000 hours of opportunity to receive training, both as being an employee, receiving instructions and responding to instructions, as well as food service.
Counsel, let me raise a concern that I have about a potential, and maybe it's not, but a potential inconsistency with your argument. assuming that this court agrees with you that this is that the duties of the jail is one of the core functions of the office of sheriff, it seems to me that this argument is focusing on this particular sheriff's desire to transfer that duty away from the sheriff by sending it to a private entity. And if this is a core function that remains with the sheriff, then I have some concerns about the sheriff losing some control by sending this off to an entity that the sheriff may not have the control over. Can you respond to that?
Thank you very much, Justice Butler. I think that to take your argument to the next step, it would be to say, and contractual relationships do not have some sort of control elements between the parties that are entering the contract. And I would say that that's not a contractual understanding. Our understanding of contracts in this state is that contracts indeed give a great deal of control to the parties that are engaging in them. One would argue, given, and I believe this is in the record, that you have the response from the Aramark company to the request for proposal specifically details the types of employees they will spend, what kind of background checks will be undertaken, what their duties and responsibilities are, how they will interact with the inmates. And those contract relationships actually upped significantly.
But if I could, the thrust of my question goes to your argument that this is a core function of the sheriff and duty of the sheriff as opposed to one of the administrative duties that the sheriff undertakes. The argument you're making now sounds administrative to me. The core function seems to be the whole focus of what the sheriff is about. And if this is truly a core function of the sheriff, it would seem to me that the sheriff ought not to be giving it away.
And I respect the question because I think it does get to the heart here. He's not giving it away. In fact, he's controlling it more so than he had while the mental health center employees who were in a relationship with a completely different employer with a different collective bargaining agreement in which the sheriff had no input and no contract which he could vary because of that. This indeed increases his control. The fact that there's a contractual element to the control should not, I think, undermine the element that this is a core function. The core function exists, and the question that the sheriff has to answer is how to meet that. In fact, that's been the lesson of case after case, including, I believe, the most recent case in Dunn. Because the sheriff, this is a quote, because the sheriff chooses the ways and means of performing protective duties, the balance between various and competing prerogatives must ultimately be struck by the sheriff. In that case, it was important to see, and in this case, it's important to see that those duties are being balanced. He didn't lease out the jail. He didn't ask Aramark to come in and take over the custody of all of the prisoners, even though there's a question as to how far he could go in that. He asked about five of them who had training and experience in helping inmates move from inmate to workmate to participate along with about 100 jailers and others in the jail.
And counsel, I know that there are other people who probably want to ask questions, but let me ask one final one. It seems to me that when we're talking about the level of control, and I understand the argument that with contract there are certain controls that can be bargained for and negotiated for, it just seems intuitively that negotiating for control is a bit less control than supervising employees that directly work underneath you.
I'm an employment and labor lawyer, Justice Butler, and in many times you're negotiating with both employees and non-employees, and they work side by side, and the responsibilities that those employees must undertake is not diminished, nor is the authority to control that reduced, because you've created a paper discussion point as to how that's going to be undertaken. Frankly, handbooks and all sorts of things interact with employers and employees. I think that this contract doesn't diminish that, nor does it in any way move it away from the core responsibilities. If that were the case, then I think both in the Washington County case, where a whole other command structure, other police departments, where there's a complete command structure and there's no allegiance to that sheriff, would have been found an improper delegation of duties. It wasn't. Likewise, when we talk about the marshal in Dane County, taking care of prison transport, that wasn't either found as some sort of improper delegation or losing control, even though the marshal's office, like a sheriff's office, is a paramilitary organization where there's a very clear command structure there. This court has not found those kinds of arrangements somehow to impact the ability of the sheriff to maintain control and custody of a immemorial, important, and principal duty that gives character and distinction. And I think that, frankly, if we move away from that standard, that long-articulated standard, we indeed are going to have to overturn Brunst and a whole bunch of cases.
Counsel?
Yes?
I don't know if we have to overturn anything. Maybe we will, but it seems to me you have two poles here. One pole is the kind of duty that's described as an immemorial principle and important duty that characterizes and distinguishes the office of sheriff. That's one pole. The other pole you have, and this language comes right out of the cases, that was the Dane County case, this is the Heitkemper case. The other pole is duties that fall within the mundane and commonplace. They're not preserved at common law. That's what Heitkemper says. And so I see it as our charge is to figure out is what the issue here more akin to the immemorial principle and important duty, or is it more akin to the mundane and the commonplace duty? Do you agree, and I'm going to ask you another question, but do you agree or disagree that that's our analysis?
I think that's a fair statement of your analysis, Justice Bradley.
Then I have to decide what is at issue. Now, it's easy for me to quote the law, but I still don't know what's really at issue here. I don't know. You talked about the duty of the sheriff that's at issue being the care and custody of the jail. That's easy for me to decide. If it's care and custody of the jail, that's a little more akin to something highfalutin, immemorial principle and important duties, you know? If we're talking about who's making dinner, then maybe that's not quite so highfalutin. If what we had at issue here was that the sheriff said, I want my inmates to have a mid-afternoon snack. Now, I could say that deals with the care and custody, and that's highfalutin. Or I could say it deals with the mundane and the commonplace, afternoon snack. Not so highfalutin. So what's at issue here, and how do we determine it? I mean, I can characterize it in a real fancy way that sounds big stuff. I can say, are we going to have hamburgers on Sunday night? That's not so big stuff. So how do we characterize it? Just the way we smells to us? So what do we do? How do we know what's really going on here?
Using your vernacular, not found in my notes, this is highfalutin. This is highfalutin because in this case we're talking about who's going to run a jail function that affects inmates, that affects the other correctional officers, that affects the public because of both the freeing up of resources and putting patrol cars and additional deputies on the street. And
we're not just talking about the food, then.
No, you're...
What are we talking about?
We are talking about all of the constitutional role that a sheriff has. There's three areas, the court, safety, and the jail. And this has a large impact upon two of those. And if you start parsing out the sheriff's ability to decide, because you say, well, it does include the very mundane piece of who's going to take the ladle full of corn and put it on the plate, and it does involve the very main mundane piece of turning on the stove underneath the corn, then by doing that, you diminish the significance of this decision.
How do I know that this isn't just a subterfuge and that the sheriff, and I mean this respectfully, but the sheriff or others similarly situated could just say, oh, let me tag on and say, I'm going to put a little bit of rehabilitation. You know, they won't be able to touch that because that sounds more akin to an immemorial principle. Rehabilitation.
That's highfalutin, Justice Bradley.
That's highfalutin. But rehabilitation for what? And then you say rehabilitation so that they can get a job at Burger King? Well, I don't know how much training you really need for that.
Well, in fact, there are standards and certifications for food service workers, as you may know. And the Aramark from inmate to workmate program actually prepares them for that certification.
Standards and certifications sounds fancy to me. My four kids have been working at places like restaurants and fast food places. And they were able to do that with standards and certifications. None of them are a chef. And that's a whole different world if you're talking about. But if you're talking about working at fast food places, there may be standards and certifications, but that's not part of my world.
And Justice Bradley, my son, too, has worked at a Dairy Queen. Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot going on there. But this
was there
is
a standard certification?
That. But if we narrow it to that, Justice Bradley, to this idea of only the food preparation, we lose some of the larger impact. And you say, how do I know that this isn't just sort of make up stuff? Well, the record's pretty clear. It's 40,000 hours of time when those inmates are otherwise watching TV or sitting in a cell or in a common area. Even that by itself would be enough. And I want to take your attention, though, for just one moment back to the Dane County case, where the Dane County Sheriff decided that he would have U.S. Marshals participate in moving inmates around. The major push on that was money. Didn't have any highfalutin stuff unless money's highfalutin. And in that case, it was determined that that was appropriate all by itself. This case is far more highfalutin because it does have a substantial impact upon those in the jail, those who are serving the jail. And remember, this couldn't have been done with the mental health center employees. That contract didn't allow it. That contract wouldn't allow this sheriff to have his inmates get that 40,000 hours of training. That's, we think, very significant.
This would be a different case if the food service had been right in the sheriff's department and there was a, quote, collective bargaining agreement. Do you think that then the new sheriff, could have come in and changed his or her mind and said, no, we're going to privatize this, we're going to have outside food service because of the same reasons that you pointed out, but you've got a collective bargaining agreement in the sheriff's department where they're preparing the food?
Well, remember that most of the cases, and there aren't many, but most of the cases, and I don't think we're going to turn the world on its tail because there are so few times this comes up, but most of the cases we're talking about have, as a backdrop, a collective bargaining agreement. And the question in those cases wasn't to balance the issue against the collective bargaining agreement. That has never been a test. And it's not a test here. The test goes back to whether we have principal, immemorial, important duties that give distinction and character
so
to the office.
The answer to Justice Wilcox's question is it would make no difference in your analysis if there had been employees subject to the bargaining agreement already in place. That makes no difference to you.
Yes, Your Honor. 5 years, 6 years ago, those employees who are Sheriff's Department employees were no longer Sheriff's Department employees, and the Mental Health Center was contracted with to do this job because the sheriff believed that it would be a more efficient and effective way to meet those needs. Today, that decision has been made differently, and I believe that that's an appropriate decision and an exercise of the sheriff's constitutional authority.
Mr. Godar, I want to try to understand at least better than I do how the real world works. If you do not prevail here, Mr. Elke prevails, but the sheriff still wants to outsource food preparation, what is the process? Do the employees have to agree to something in a collective bargaining agreement, or what's the process?
Justice Prosser, I don't know I can give you a definitive answer. The collective bargaining agreement, I believe, is Exhibit 1, which is attached, of course, to the documents that this court has. The collective bargaining agreement isn't between the sheriff and these employees, as it has been made clear. The collective bargaining agreement allows for the county to lay off mental health center employees. It's a very interesting piece of work because it doesn't say that they can't lay them off, and it says that they can lay them off for important reasons. I don't have the exact words in front of me. I apologize. And once they're laid off, those employees have the opportunity to bump into other positions, to be recalled. I don't know, Justice Prosser, whether there would be any violation of someone else's collective bargaining agreement if we did this. The question, though, is what other avenues did this sheriff have? It seemed to us that the best avenue was one that has been created through a declaratory ruling, because there the sheriff has an opportunity to bring all of this into place. Now, it should be you should be reminded, perhaps, and it's in the record again, that the county did indicate a willingness to bargain over this decision, over the impact of the decision, because they didn't believe that they had, apparently, the interest in having a different position on this than the sheriff had already expressed. Even when in 2001 the sheriff agreed to hire the mental health center to do this, then the county executive recognized that as an appropriate exercise of the sheriff's authority.
I've looked through these cases, and in I think almost all the ones I got with me, the agreement between the deputy sheriffs is between the deputy sheriffs, the union, and the county. Sometimes these cases say that the sheriff joins that contract, but other times not. So the fact that this is a county contract seems to me, I question whether that's determinative. That question was asked of Mr. Elke. You know, what is this contract? Who's contracting? Is the sheriff involved? Why is he involved at all? Why can't he do whatever he wants? Because he's not part of this collective bargaining agreement. So I don't know the answer to that, and apparently you don't either. But I'm just telling you that in these other cases, it's the county that it has the collective bargaining agreement, and the issue is whether or not the sheriff can do something that violates that county collective bargaining agreement.
And going back to Justice Prosser said, give me a reality check, Mr. Godar, and a reality check, Chief Justice Abramson, is that in collective bargaining, the sheriff, if he had direct employees, would be represented at the table and has significant input. Here, there's no representative.
We don't know that because you don't know that. I understand that you don't
know
that.
I'm trying to address Justice Prosser's question. He said, what is the reality check?
I have another question for you. In the briefs and in the original arguments, there was a question as to work not being here as a party. Is that question still open?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. They have never asked to be part of it. There was a stipulation that we would proceed on this between parties on this route rather than wonder whether or not they would be here.
And this is a declaratory judgment, is there, and I didn't check it, but a declaratory judgment, is it under 227 or is it under a particular other provision, like declaratory judgment on rules or special rules that require work to be a party?
Not that we're aware of, Your Honor. It was not under 227. It was under, 806?
Okay.
What would be the – well, there are other sheriffs who have outsourced food preparation. Isn't that correct?
If I understand your use of the word outsource, meaning that they have a public-private partnership to provide some of the activities related to serving, maintaining the kitchen, I think the answer is yes, and I believe that's in the record, Mr. Prosser.
If you lose, what effect would our decision have on those other arrangements?
On those other arrangements? I do not know that there's, at this point, what kind of other arrangements those counties have with employees or collective bargaining, or whether or not it has any impact, or whether that allows everybody to start saying, well, way back when, I should have taken some other steps, Justice Prosser. I'm not sure of the answer to that. But we do know that in the relationship with the sheriff to accomplish those things which he must accomplish, there are those kinds of relationships, whether they're with other public sector entities, whether they're marshal's offices or other joint relationships. Sometimes, for instance, prisoners are transported outside of the sheriff's department. Those kinds of things are happening routinely because that is part of the sheriff's need to meet his constitutional mandate or her constitutional
Counsel,
mandate.
Counsel, if you win, I want to follow up, and there are other sheriff's departments that have employees that are preparing the food that are subject to collective bargaining and are represented. If you win, then as I understand it, those sheriff's departments can take the position, we're not bound, this is part of my constitutional authority, and I can outsource. Is that correct?
I think you're, Justice Bradley, that at the centerpiece, we're going to agree, and I don't think that this court is likely to find that the jail and the care of inmates is other than a constitutional duty. You will end up with the balance on a case-by-case basis, as the Dunn case told us, to determine.
See if you can answer my question. And I mean that respectfully, because we're running out of time. If you win, and there are counties, Outagamie, Winnebago, Richland, who currently have employees in the jail that are doing the food service and that are subject to collective bargaining positions, if you win and we say, no, this is the decision of who makes the food is of in care and custody is of constitutional dimension, then those sheriffs can outsource food regardless of having employees currently in the jail who are subject to collective bargaining. Am I correct or incorrect?
I believe Sheriff Kokin could do that, and I believe that other sheriff's departments will have an opportunity to review that as well.
Thank you.
I see my time is up. I'm happy, of course,
Thank
to answer other
counsel.
Questions in court. Thank you very much.
If your answer is correct, could they do that at any time during the life of a collective bargaining agreement?
If this is, as we believe it is, of a constitutional magnitude, and it is not, in that case, because I do believe we will end up looking at the specific circumstances of that change, if that change really is about opportunities that give care and distinction to the office rather than just the mundane activities. Yes, Justice Prosser, I believe so.
Wouldn't that then be sanctioning a breach of contract by the sheriff, a constitutional officer?
I think no more so than it's sanctioned a breach of contract by the sheriff in the Manitowoc County case, in WPPA 1, in WPPA 2. All of those cases felt this tension between a collective bargaining agreement. Go ahead.
But I'm following up. This is a slightly different situation that was posed to you by Justice Prosser. This is not a sheriff in these other counties who's brought this action, who's followed the route that Sheriff Kokin did. We have a valid collective bargaining agreement that's on the table, may or may not have been entered into by the sheriff, and now as a result of this ruling, as I understood your answer, that sheriff would be able to say, well, this contract is meaningless. Let's go privatize.
I believe you've overstated the impact, certainly making a contract meaningless, with all due respect, Justice Butler. But I think your question is an excellent one. But that is the same question that this Court has had to face, not just in the question as to whether or not, as is here, there may or may not be a violation of the contract, but here this Court has said an arbitrator's decision, which interpreted a contract, would not be enforced because of a sheriff's constitutional role. I believe that what we're asking for here today is that we maintain the same standard, the same analysis, and frankly the same result except for three cases which merely talked about hiring or terminating a deputy as this Court has adopted for 136 years, Your Honor.
And I'm sorry, and I know your time is up, but I need to follow that up because the concern then is raised that if the collective bargaining agreements could be voided as a result of this because of the sheriff's inherent powers, then what is to keep the sheriff from invoking that same inherent power to void out contracts with private entities if he decides that things aren't working well?
For about 30 years now, that tension has been faced by sheriffs, collective bargaining agents, the state, and the Supreme Court. And we have not seen any willy-nilly running away from collective bargaining obligations. We have seen a very careful analysis by sheriffs, by collective bargaining agents, and by this court, as well as other courts, that looks carefully at whether or not in a particular circumstance, whether this was true in the Dunn County case, whether it was true in the Manitowoc case, whether this would be an enforceable obligation of a sheriff in spite of the constitutional authority and role that he has. In our case, we believe clearly that 136 or 137 years of precedent and the progeny of the Bruns case indicates that this sheriff has the right to make this specific decision. And I believe you can have your decision maintain that relatively close and careful analysis on a case-by-case basis.
Now, you asked in your complaint, if I've got the right complaint, judgment in your favor, declaring that the current collective bargaining agreement with the county cannot be used to limit, impede, or take away powers reserved for the sheriff as regards to his choice in changing meal service for the inmates. That's still your view?
Yes.
Okay. You wanted a preliminary and permanent injunctions, which the court gave you, trial court, in favor of the sheriff, prohibiting the union from restricting or curbing in any way, including filing or maintaining a prohibited practice complaint before work. So you wanted to prohibit the union from restricting or curbing the sheriff's authority to take care and custody of the inmates, changing food service delivery system. Still want that. And you wanted reasonable, and that was given. You got a permanent injunction.
We received both a temporary and a permanent injunction.
And you asked for an award of reasonable costs and attorney fees that the sheriff has incurred. Did you get that?
No, Your
Honor. No. But you're not cross-appealing on that?
No, we are not.
Okay. And what else did you get from the trial court that you want us to affirm?
Your Honor, I believe that an affirmation of the trial court's decision would be sufficient here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Elke?
It would appear that the gist of the argument here is that regardless of the existence of a collective bargaining agreement, regardless of the So long as the sheriff can say that the issue that I'm addressing has to do with law enforcement and preservation of public safety, so long as the sheriff puts that tag on his decision, the argument that Brown County Sheriff is making here is that the decision is not subject to legislative control of any sort.
Well, your opposing counsel wants it much narrower in a case by case. He wants us to look at this situation and come up with an answer.
Yes.
But you're saying, no, you can't do that because what we do is it's going to, the sky is going to fall. And
well, the sky doesn't, it's not, no, the sky isn't going to fall, but it certainly is going to have an impact, just like the
just like the
decision in the Manitowoc County case has had an impact that the Court of Appeals and other parties have been trying to
I asked, and I'll ask you, if there was a collective bargaining agreement here right in the Sheriff's Department to prepare the food, would this come out differently?
Would make no difference.
It would make no difference.
The collective bargaining agreements are negotiated between a labor organization that represents county employees and the county board. Mm-hmm. The collective bargaining agreements are, in effect, an extension of the county board. They are no different in legal effect than a civil service ordinance or a resolution passed by the county board that relates to the employment of the county employees. There's no difference at all. So what we're talking about here is really the authority of the county board to act in regard to the matters that are before the court.
Now, is it your position that if the court would say that the sheriff has, it's part of the sheriff's constitutional duty and power to deal with food service in the jail, that's the position, then every sheriff in this state, regardless of collective bargaining agreements, can deal with food service as the sheriff pleases.
I don't see where you could draw the line. I don't see there would be any different. It would be indifferent for any other sheriff than it would be for the Brown County sheriff. The sheriff would have the authority.
Constitutional
authority to make whatever decisions he or she wished with respect to how the food preparation and service was handled, without regard to any civil service ordinance, collective bargaining agreement, county ordinance, state statute, without regard to any of those things. Because the sheriff would stand in the same, he'd be on the same footing as the legislature. Essentially, the sheriff would be the fourth branch of government.
But, Counselor, it doesn't follow, at least for me, it doesn't follow that if a sheriff has made a personal contractual arrangement with some organization, some private organization, that the Constitution gives the sheriff any power to breach that contract, correct?
Are you talking about the contract the sheriff has made with the private organization?
Well,
or the contract?
That's right. So the constitutional powers has nothing to do with whether that contract remains in effect. We just look at regular contract law, correct?
I think the answer to that is yes.
So your argument is essentially what we're looking at here is, does the power of the county board contravene the sheriff's constitutional power? And if it doesn't, then the collective bargaining agreement controls, and there's the statute that says there's an obligation to bargain in good faith controls. And if it does, then the sheriff doesn't have to bargain in the first instance. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah.
You don't know whether what the sheriff's role was in this collective bargaining agreement.
What we know is this. The collective bargaining agreement is between the county, acting by its county board, and the AFSCME Local Union 1901. Those are the parties to the contract. And the sheriff is subject to that collective bargaining agreement, or we would argue he is, as would be the case of any other department head. Incidentally, when counsel said that the previous county executive agreed that they didn't have authority, she also said she expected he would have the same influence and the same authority as any other department head.
Well, what are the usual collective bargaining agreements on the deputies? Does it involve the sheriff, or does it involve only the county board, or does it involve both, or neither, or don't you know?
In virtually every case that I have seen, the contract is between the county acting by its county board and the labor organization. I don't recall seeing a collective bargaining agreement that was actually signed by or to which a sheriff or any other county department head was party.
And that regulates the deputy sheriff.
Correct.
Okay, that's all I want to know. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Elke. Does anyone else have questions? Okay, Mr. Elke, and thank you, Mr. Godar, for your interesting arguments today on yet another case that involves an issue we've seen before, namely constitutional powers of the sheriff. Very important issue and well argued. That concludes our hearing on 2005 AP 2742. Coffin versus Wisconsin Council 40 AFSCME et al. The court will be in